everybody. I'm here with Amy Ann and Everett, their beautiful house in Austin with very cool art and an axe. Amy Ann and Everett are leaders in the Austin spiritual community, both really wonderful, beautiful people, and I'm so excited to talk to them today about a movement they are starting called Erotic Mysticism. So, welcome to my show.
Thank you so much, Paige, for having us. We're super excited to be here.
Yeah, thank you for being here. Excited to talk about it all.
Just as an FYI for my listeners, the role of my show is usually that the guests drink coffee or tea. I had a feeling that Amy Ann and Everett were Austin sober, which means you do not drink alcohol, caffeine, or tea, but you do MDMA. Found out that's not true, so we're all drinking wine. Are you big coffee drinkers? Like, what's the feel
energy drink?
I drink coffee. Yeah, I love me a really, really good latte.
Let's just jump right into it, because this is a topic that is very unfamiliar and very interesting to me.
So, erotic mysticism. It's a practice of exploring the concepts and the energies of Eros in a way that connects us to a higher power, to the divine. And so really, if you were to break up kind of those two words and look at erotic or Eros and mysticism, we'll say that Eros, as the root of erotic, is life instinct. It's passionate love, it's drive. And really the best way to describe it is it's that will for life to expand and to grow. So we'll say the energy of the Big Bang is life force energy. It's Eros, right? Eros can also be described as that passionate feeling that you have when you meet somebody. And a lot of times people maybe misunderstand that as I'm sexually attracted to this person. And unfortunately, like I would say, culture really sees Eros as lust. It's way more sophisticated and way more wholesome. And so this is just the human desire and drive to expand itself lovingly. It's a frequency of love that's meant to passionately drive itself. And so mysticism is the study of, or is one study and connection to the divine. And so really, erotic mysticism is using the energy of Eros to understand.
Okay, give me a little bit of background. Eros and the divine, are these concepts, are these figures? What do these look like to you? Can you just expand on that?
So Eros is definitely a concept that's been around for a few thousand years. It was originally a god in ancient Greece, and they had different versions of it. There's a form of Eros that was one of the first progenitors of reality and the universe. One of their stories says that the whole universe comes from this god Eros. Out of chaos, Eros arose and brought forth order. And then that transformed into another version of Eros that was the son of Aphrodite, who's the goddess of love. And that Eros was really more about like passionate, sexual, romantic love, but really that sexual energy kind of run through the heart and married with unconditional love, in our opinion. So it's both a figure, like a mythic figure and an archetype that now we use this term in culture, and people talking about Eros kind of usually know some of this background. This background and this mythos infuses our understanding of what Eros is now, which is more like an energy, something you experience in the body between yourself and the divine, yourself and yourself, and yourself and other.
Something that I've been fascinated by in terms of exploring Eros is looking at how culture and society has viewed Eros throughout different civilizations. And so really Eros comes from kind of, we'll say, the Greek civilization. And really their depiction of Eros through the gods was this kind of really poised, really balanced sex god of a man. And so that was kind of their way of personifying how they related with Eros, the frequency of Eros. Now you go to the Roman times, that sex god named Eros became Cupid, this kind of little baby that was creating mischief. And so the Roman culture started to see Eros as something to lust over, something that created problems, something that you kind of had to shy away from. And so that kind of devolved in a lot of ways how society looked at it. And so it's interesting to now bring that concept back in the Greek way, in ways where it's balanced, in ways where it's coming from wholesome. It's coming from a place of wholesomeness, in a way that it's coming from the heart, in a way that it's also respected. And so that's kind of a big part of our mission with what we're actually calling the Eros Renaissance right now. This is definitely a time of renaissance where so much culture is expanding in art, philosophy, spirituality in so many ways. And for us, really the wave that we're riding is the wave of Eros, how that's bringing itself back into culture in ways that really feels good and supports people's personal growth and their soul growth and their connections with other people.
And one key about Eros, I would say, a lot of people feel like it's synonymous with sex or sexuality. And we believe it's so much more than that, that sexual energy, like in the old paradigm, it's like sexual energy must lead to penetrative physical sex. But for our understanding, that energy can be transformed and it can actually lift out of the genitals, lift out of the lower sex centers.
And what? Lift out of the genitals?
I can don't know, like sexual energy or sex. You know, sex is in the genitals, right? An energy that can be experienced like a full body experience, and it can fuel so much more than just sex. It can actually help you reach other states of consciousness and awareness when you learn how to use it and work with it differently and move it differently in your body. And you can go into altered states of consciousness and transcendent states of awareness, like mystical states, without any plant medicine, without any substances, by just using erotic energy. And that's that the erotic mysticism part is that erotic energy can actually fuel these altered states and this feeling of union with the divine.
Just as an FYI, most of my listeners are like tech people in Silicon Valley. So this is really good for them to listen to, because I feel like you're right. There is a big wave of erotic energy. I feel like that is overtaking a lot of people. You know, a lot of people feel lonely. They feel helpless. They feel not connected. And I feel like when that happens, when you have all this pent up energy, it just releases in different ways. It's not always sexual, you're right, in terms of like unifying with someone else, but I do see a push for intimacy. In my own life, I've experienced people wanting to get intimate with each other really quickly for friendship, for work, for all of it. In your experience, what does this wave of Eros look like? Is it what I'm describing, or are you experiencing and seeing something else?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that what you're explaining right now, the human desire for more intimacy, is directly related to us consciously or subconsciously feeling Eros in our bodies and wanting to do something with it. And so we'll say that humans are translating Eros as attraction and turn on, right? And so what happens when we meet somebody or are in a circumstance with someone else where we're feeling attraction and turn on, right? When we don't understand what that means or what's happening, a lot of times the human condition is what? Suppress it.
Push it down.
Push it down.
That's scary.
Let's not talk about it. This is inappropriate. What happens if that happens? And that's connected to kind of that Cupid energy, mischievous baby energy. But really what we're wanting to do is bring back the wisdom, the wise man of integrity or the wise person of integrity that knows how to wield this energy with love. And so the frequency of Eros, the attraction, the turn on that happens is not just sexual. It can also be in creative circumstances. Right? Have you ever been in a circumstance where you're creating with someone and you're like, oh my God, this is just working. We're in a flow state. I feel so drawn and attracted and magnetized to this person or group of people because of this creative alchemy that's happening, right? So that's also a feeling of Eros. Also, in other times, if we are, say, having a spiritual experience with someone or people, and there's this feeling of divine God spirit that's happening, that's also a shared experience of Eros, right? And so it's so much more beyond just sex or lust or anything like that. And so to understand that this energy, this life force creation energy that's moving through us to birth a creative project, to connect to the divine or to make babies, right? All of this energy is the same. And so to understand that it's actually not an evil force or something to be worried about, but rather something that we can actually wield and use and harness to create more is really how we can integrate this energy into our lives. And so to bring it back to the erotic mystic, the erotic mystic is someone who is fascinated with this energy and uses it in their own unique, creative, magical way to create the things they want, to garner more personal growth, to have a spiritual relationship with whatever they want, to feel connected to source, creator, something higher. And it becomes this like almost superpower in a way. So it's very similar in how we are now collectively understanding emotions as an intelligence, the EQ side of things. There's also what we call erotic intelligence, understanding the eros that's moving through our body or that's in the situation that's happening, and really being able to call it what it is, understand what it is, not be afraid of it, and lean in ways of clarity that creates safety. And once that happens, it's like, okay, great. We're both feeling this energy. We're all feeling this energy. Let's turn it into something magical. Let's create something. And so to speak directly to kind of, we'll say, your tech audience, right? Like everybody in there, like they are amazing at creating all the things that they're creating. You know, they're building so many amazing systems and products and solutions for this world. And so just in the name of creative eros, right, for people in the team setting, for people in one-on-one creative dynamic settings, to understand that there is an energy and a life force that's wanting to move through them to create and birth these projects is absolutely vital in the creative process, in my opinion.
Almost the way I see it is taking ideas from the realm of ideas and imagination and turning them into something tangible in the real. Mm. Just like erotic energy in terms of making a baby brings like spirit or, you know, soul into matter. It's like bringing imagination into matter in any form through arts, through business projects, through whatever. And that's an alchemy of different energies and this life force energy making something real.
Interesting. So when you were talking, Everett, I thought erotic mysticism just referred to intimacy between people, but it sounds like it also covers creativity. Can someone experience erotic mysticism by itself?
1,000,000%. Like by themselves without somebody else? 1,000,000%.
Interesting. Okay. I'm not going to make any jokes. Oh, no, this is really serious. Yeah. I don't know. Honestly, whenever you read about religions and different stories, it's like Mary had a Holy Spirit visit her in the middle of the night, and that is what led to the birth of Jesus. It's just like, sex seems so
taboo.
Yes. And then also it's just so entrenched in everything. It's like there is something related to sex that led to the birth of a universe, which I guess makes sense. Why is everyone so focused on sex? I feel like you're right. There are so many different spaces you could take erotic mysticism that are just as fulfilling as sex. But I feel like the majority of people who are listening to this episode, and then also people who get involved in the space initially, because they're interested in physical intimacy. Why do you feel like that is? There are some other fundamental questions I want to ask before this one, but I really want to know what you do when someone gets in your space and they are just about sex, which I'm sure happens.
Good question. Okay, so first one, can you experience erotic mysticism or eros all by yourself? 100%. 100%. And something that we teach people that we work with is how to be self-sourced, how to take radical self-responsibility for you yourself and be as being a sovereign human being. And really when you're self-sourced, you're able to cultivate that level of life force energy within yourself so that you're not taking from other people. And I think that's the big problem when people don't understand how to be self-sourced within themselves. What happens? They look to others to, ooh, I need to take, oh, I need that energy.
To fill a hole.
And to break it down in very simple terms, ooh, I need to have sex with you because I'm super horny, right?
Literally fill a hole.
Right? And if there's a bunch of humans out there that are taking from other takers, that really leads to a horrible world, right? That doesn't create an abundant,
lack, scarcity.
Exactly. And so to be self-sourced is actually kind of one of the foundational steps in becoming a sovereign human, a whole human. And you know, another thing that I really don't like hearing is when people are like, oh, I found my other half, right? Oh, I found my person and they complete me. Mm-hmm. To me, that is a very false statement. That's something where you're kind of sourcing from someone else to be whole. Really what I believe when it comes to union and intimacy in romantic partnerships is that it should be two whole people that are coming together. And their union specifically is a whole third kind of entity or thing that they're feeding both of themselves into. And so it's you, it's me, and then it's us all together. And so that, for me, is how I would answer being self-sourced mm-hmm. and can you do it by yourself? Mm-hmm. Amy Ann also teaches amazing embodiment practices and energy practices for one to cultivate more of this all on her own.
It's extra though.
I was just thinking while you were talking, I was thinking about how a lot of people don't just look to other people to fill them. But these days, it's like the porn industry is so massive and rampant, right? And so there's a big hole and you feel like you need to watch something and get off that way or scratch this itch or drugs or alcohol or any kind of substance that numbs you out or helps you cope with the stresses and anxieties of our modern world. To me, that's all outsourcing. It's outsourcing your power in a way, and it's outsourcing your comfort and your fulfillment. And all of that in the end, I find and I've found in my own life and in people I coach and work with in their lives is that it leaves you emptier in the end. You're always looking for that other hit. And that's also why people can get addicted to porn or sex with others or whatnot, because they're always looking to fill that hole that's never ending. So it's why self-sourcing and learning how to self-source and turn that energy back in on yourself, that longing that you have to find love elsewhere and to be validated and affirmed outside of yourself, to actually give that thing to yourself. It's usually our wounded inner children that are aching for mommy and daddy to really fill that for us. The parts of us that didn't get that as children, we can learn to be our own parents now and fill all of those places. It's an ongoing process. Mm. I've spent years doing this and I feel like I'm more integrated now than ever. And it's still an ongoing journey, you know? But one of the methods I have is called the orgasmic healing method where you, So the orgasmic healing method is really learning how to self-source your pleasure and to heal yourself with orgasmic energy, which is a form of erotic energy. To turn that back on yourself and to also expand it, as I was saying earlier, outside of the lower centers and being able to feed your whole body with it and being able to marry that energy with unconditional love energy and pour that energy into yourself to really make love to yourself spiritually, energetically, physically. And then that unlocks actually full body orgasms, for example, for both men and women. And it can unlock.
Is the strategy for this just buy a vibrator? Like if someone wanted to do this, how would they accomplish that?
Ideally not a vibrator because it's another way to outsource.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So like with a vibrator, it's like mostly you, but I see. Okay.
Still enough. It's something outside yourself that you're, you know, versus, so the main techniques of this are, well, one is unconditional love and getting into the unconditional love frequency, which is a frequency everyone can feel. And then bringing that frequency to your sex centers and really sending that love and allowing that love and blessing into those places, because we are all carrying so much shame and guilt and pain body in those centers. Ancestrally from our genetic lines and culturally from everything we've inherited around us. And so it's that shame and guilt that actually distorts our sexual energy and causes us to like do these things that aren't very healthy for us and not very healthy for others often. So healing that shame and guilt is like number one, and doing practices to bring unconditional love there is like foundational, and also moving stuck emotions around that. So like, if we have fear, if we have rage, anger, some stuff stuck, these negative emotions stuck in our body, we've got to move that. Otherwise, it clamps down our energy and the energy won't move. So we learn how to move that through breath, sound, movement, different emotional alchemy practices. And then once that's freed up, you're actually able to cultivate this energy and then breathe that and bring that through your whole body. And that's, there's different presencing tools for that, like really getting so present to the sensation in the body now and naming it aloud, bringing pleasure to that sensation. There's a whole process you can go through. And then really stirring and doing energy work on yourself, stirring that energy up from the lower centers up to the heart. And that's when you can experience these like full body shakes, full body pleasure, full body bliss, and this sense of union with the divine.
So many things I want to ask you, but I think the biggest question is, why do you both feel like our culture is so against pleasure? I mean, it's true. I feel like, to put this in a delicate way, but I feel like so many industries and religions and practices are centered around you cannot feel pleasure because it's bad for you. Of course, things like addiction are bad, right? Like alcoholism, sex addiction, porn addiction, those are all bad. But if you're able to, none of those things, FYI, I don't think anyone should really do those things in moderation. I guess alcohol's kind of fine and sex is necessary for procreation. But like, I don't think porn is good. Anyway, I digress. I'm going off on a tangent. Why is it that we fixate on areas of pleasure as just fundamentally bad or shameful? Like, why do we have such a negative reaction to pleasure?
I think there's a social conditioning that has happened over time that shames this part of us that wants to feel pleasure. And unfortunately, I think that it really cuts us off from being able to experience the fullness of life in so many ways. And pleasure, not just being sexual pleasure, but mm-hmm. pleasure across the board, period. And perhaps there is some form of guilt or shaming about feeling bigger than one should. You know, I know for me personally, you know, growing up the way that I did, there was this whole like, oh, don't stand out, don't be too big, you know, just kind of fall in line and don't make any trouble, right?
Poppies. There are so many idioms. Tall poppies get cut down, craps in a bucket. Mm-hmm.
The nail that stands out gets hammered down. And so there's this fear of standing out. And for me, Mike, almost a big part of my pain to purpose story was overcoming that conditioning that I inherited from my family in a lot of ways. And that was a safety thing. I think that was a safety thing for them that came out of, we'll say, a lot of the trauma that came from World War II that then kind of inherited down to me. And so I would say that it, for me, felt wrong to suppress myself. It actually took more energy for me to hold myself back rather than to just be liberated and let it fly. And my arc and my hero's journey of understanding that was going from, okay, I'm just going to let it fly. And even that level of freedom, right, would trigger other people or would be a little bit too much. And so, okay, maybe that's not that much, but how can I then allow myself to be fully liberated in my freedom of expression, be in my pleasure, enjoy it, while also alchemizing with other people, while also creating harmony with my surroundings and everyone around me. Mm-hmm. And to also bring it back to erotic mysticism, that level of study is how we can create a 1+1=3 or more kind of paradigm with this level of energy or pleasure. So how can my pleasure, my level of freedom and liberation not only make me feel good, but make her feel good, make you feel good, make everybody around me that's affected by me feel good? And I think that a lot of culture, a lot of people now because a lot of people don't understand how to use that energy or harness that energy, it's like, oh, wow, if I let it go, it's just going to blow everything up, right? So there's a fear of rocking the boat. There's a fear of hurting others. There's fear of being judged around it. And so to kind of go through this journey of what we're calling erotic mysticism is the study of this energy, I think, creates ways to do it that feel safe and that feel empowering to me and that feel empowering to you and everyone else around.
I love that answer. Can I add something? I want people to just think about how common it is for us to hear negative language in others, to hear people complaining about their life, about the weather, about their neighbor, gossiping negatively about people. How baseline that is in normal culture, isn't it? It's so normal. And family, if you think about family dinners, how much negativity gets thrown around there. And that feels like, oh, like our nervous systems are like, yeah, great. But then when we hear someone in pleasure or sounds of pleasure, like, like all of a sudden it's like, oh my God, shut it off. What is that? Oh, like,
I don't know what to do with it.
I remember my mom, like anytime there was a love making scene on TV or anything, or even starting the makeout scene, she would cover our eyes and our ears, you know?
That definitely stops people from having sex. She was so smart. Like when you get your eyes covered, you never want to experience it. You don't think about it.
But like, what is that in us that's so afraid and gets so uncomfortable and triggered by sounds of pleasure versus sounds and frequencies of negativity? I just want to posit that to your audience and your listeners to like start thinking about that and why, and think about your own response when you hear sounds of pleasure.
Interesting. So I actually don't want to talk too much about the negative responses people have to erotic mysticism, but now is as good as time as any to ask the one question I had about it, which is, how do you feel about the negative responses you get from religious communities and from other people who say things like, you're being childish, you're not being an adult, you're not in college anymore, or this is satanic, you're playing with dark energy? I feel like those are the two biggest pushbacks I see. They are different in nature. The first group, people that think you are being childish or want you to grow up, how would you respond to them?
That's so interesting, because part of me that's like, this to me feels the most grown up. It's like, instead of creating splits in my own being and my psyche of like, this needs to be in the closet or reserved for the bedroom, or I never talk about this, and this other thing is out in the open or in church on Sunday. And then if we see in culture what happens to people who have psychic splits in themselves, it ends up creating problems. They have side relationships or affairs or all these things because they're split within themselves, you know? So I'm like, why not bring it all together? Why not bring sexuality and spirituality to the table together and create more inner union? Why don't we come to the table with less shame? And actually, when we do that, we actually become more whole human beings, and we're operating from places that feel whole inside rather than shadow aspects of ourselves that have been suppressed or repressed, you know, that usually in a lot of people are running the show, or it's like we have the shadow self.
I have a shadow self? No, I don't want a shadow self.
It's like the things we can't see about ourselves that are kind of the underlying motivations.
Yes.
But when you're doing this work, it means that you get to look at your shadow parts, you get to bring them into the light, you get to love on them more, and then they're not like wreaking havoc from the sidelines anymore. They're not causing you to do things that are out of integrity with the persona that you're portraying to the world, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, I would say to both of those parties, like, do you feel like you're living your fullest, most liberated life and are in integrity with that? To me, it doesn't matter what religion or what philosophy that you want to live by, so long as it feels true to you. And for me, this feels true to me because it allows for me to be in my fullest expression. It allows for me to look at aspects of myself that are afraid or that are suppressed. And it allows for me to then actually grow through those. And so for a lot of what this work does, it actually puts me in situations where I need to look at these shadow aspects of myself or parts of myself that are unseen, and it unearths aspects that I've actually either been suppressing or afraid to look at. And it allows for me to grow through those versus burying them down somewhere and never looking at them because they're bad, evil, forbidden. And so pretty much everything is welcome to look at so long as I can actually face it with love.
And the key to this, too, is creating safe containers for you to explore these energies. So there's something we call shadow theater, where you create a safe container and then you let's say it's like a shadow of jealousy, fully animate you. And you just like say the things and act the things that you would never want anyone to hear. Like, oh, my God, I'm so jealous of that girl who knows how to rip it off her face and stick it on mine.
Oh, my God.
You know, those things that you're kind of thinking in the unconscious, but we don't ever allow ourselves to say out loud.
Probably good.
Yeah, but you know, if you don't ever let them out and look at them, then this is where it comes out in negative things like gossip, or you do like passive aggressive things because you're actually really angry at someone, but you don't want to say it. So if you create a safe container and a safe space for you to express these things, then you can alchemize them, then it can transform, and then they don't have like power over you in the same way anymore. And the key to that is creating a non-judgmental space where you're not judging yourself, other people who are witnessing you aren't judging you, and you can just play out these energies in a safe way. Does that make sense?
That answers my questions around people who say you're being childish, right? Because it helps you to be a more functional adult. What about people who are like, you're communicating with the devil, you have dark energy, you're letting Satan wash over you? I have to say, yeah, I was like, do I say the painting? There is a painting of what looks like a devil with breasts. I'm going to be real. Did not take a photo of it. If I took a photo of that and I sent it to some of my more conservative friends, they would be calling me nonstop, asking where I am so they can pick me up. I would say, like, when I think about dangers to our community, it goes to people who are like, how are you going to pay your bills? I don't think you should bring kids in this. Those are all, like, annoying questions. But for those, you can be like, okay, you're just making sure I'm functioning normally and that I'm happy and healthy. That's not necessarily from a place of judgment in a hateful way. There are some people who would love to see that painting you have burned in front of them. There are some people, your mom's one of them, yeah.
That painting is by we have a roommate named Alex Ruiz, amazing artist. Everybody check him out. I feel like it is a representation of these energies, these primal, feral, kind of more animal energies that we all have that we deny. And when we deny them, they come out in ways that the Christian evangelicals would call demonic. But they're really just aspects of ourselves that are wanting to find an outlet and an expression. So that's what I think that is. Would I normally have a piece of art like that in my place if I wasn't living with the artist? Probably not. But I can appreciate it for what it is.
If one were to simply focus on the light, we'll say, you know, there's a term in the spiritual community called spiritual bypassing. To just, everything is love and light and blessings. Everything is good. Everything is positive. And anything that dark is, that comes that is dark, quote unquote, we just can't handle, right? To me, to be in totality of life means we embrace the light and the dark, right? With the yin and the yang.
And dark, right? Doesn't mean evil.
And dark does not necessarily mean evil. Dark is the shadow aspect, the primal aspect, the other aspects that we're maybe afraid of or are misunderstanding. And so to say that it's demonic and it's evil, to me, actually, I don't live in a black and white paradigm like mm-hmm. that. Where it's like, it's either, you're either good or you're evil. Like, to me, is any one person good or evil?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah, look at Donald Trump. He's clearly totally evil. I meet people at the DMV and in TSA, and I'm like, you got this job because you were totally evil. It's interesting, right? Because the DMV and TSA meet people, you're either like, you're a total angel or you're a total devil, and there's no in between. I'm just teasing. I understand what you mean. Yes.
I completely disagree with that. Is everybody inside of them has good aspects, has dark aspects. And to me, that is love. And to be able to see any human from that perspective of wholeness is actually how we can break barriers. Instead of being separate, instead of saying, you are other, you are someone else, you are evil, you are doing this thing. To me, that's not actually creating connection. That's not creating love. That isn't love. That's creating more and more separation. And unfortunately, so many of the world and the problems and the wars and the fights that have happened are because of that thing. I'm living in a black and white paradigm. I am good and you are clearly evil because I am good and you disagree with me and I don't know you. To me, that's a huge problem in this world. And I wish, I really, really wish that that could end. And for me, I've also been afraid of other people that are different than me. And to actually come to a place of understanding, connection, building bridges of connection is actually saying, you know what? I am good and I am also evil too. I am light and I am also dark, as you are light and you are dark. So you know what? Let's actually have a conversation like humans. I'm not afraid of my darkness, of the things that I feel guilty about, I feel shame about, I feel afraid about, mm-hmm. things that I've done that I really, really regret because I became a monster in that moment. And guess what? That's the human experience. The human experience of free will, of us getting to be humans and having free will, is our ability to experience the full spectrum of it all. The light, the dark, and everything in between. And guess what? All humans live in between all of that, in my opinion. And to understand that allows for us to all, as humans, to be on the same scale. I'm not better than you. You are not better than me. We're all humans playing this human experience game to the best of our abilities. So you know what? Let me actually have some compassion for who you are. Mm-hmm. Let me actually be curious as to what your opinion is. Maybe, and we can agree to disagree. That's totally fine, mm-hmm. right? And I'm not calling you a purely evil person, mm-hmm. right? I'm here to listen and to understand. And to me, when people start to open themselves up to listening to these things is how we can actually start building bridges rather than creating walls. And it really starts within ourselves, right? Within ourselves, accepting this light and dark and everything in between and having the courage to face that and love that and have compassion for that and understand that so that we can figure that out within ourselves. And then we can start doing that with other. And maybe then we can start creating some connection points.
What would you all say to the idea that erotic mysticism is just hedonism? Because that is ultimately the criticism that's coming from both sides. Put aside the trappings of you're living in perpetual adolescence or you're being simple. I think the pushback, I don't really like the word pushback. It's like so 2012 woke. It's true. Everybody's like, I got to push back. Pushing back on you because you're like from Dallas. Okay. The biggest criticism I feel like that ultimately comes when you look at erotic mysticism is the idea that you're just focused on yourself and focused on pleasure and that you're not really doing things for other people because you are so focused on self and self-pleasure. I interviewed someone who got involved in the Austin spirituality scene and had a really just horrible experience. She jumped headfirst into Christianity and like has renounced everything as demonic. It's super interesting. She was telling me she feels like it is just a worship of yourself. That's what leads to bad things in life. What do you have to say to that?
I'm still kind of stuck on the last one. I wanted to mention one last thing about force and how erotic mysticism is kind of like the force in Star Wars, or like just our understanding of reality is a bit like that, where there is the dark side and there's the light side. And we're always somewhere in between, and you can choose at any moment which side you choose, you know? So along that line with self-pleasure, it's like you can use self-pleasure for self-serving and you can get caught in those loops and be very selfish and just kind of worship yourself. Or you can fill your own cup and give yourself what you need and what you're seeking elsewhere and really come from a place of nourishment and overflow. And then from that place, serve your community and serve others rather than from a place of guilt or obligation or something like that, or from a place of lack. I'm not doing enough for the world. I got to go and do it. There's so much, especially in the masculine too, but I know I come from a long line of women who overgive and who did not take care of their own selves, their own health, their own pleasure. They were just giving to their children, to their husbands, to their work, to the farm, all these things, to the point where they were run ragged. And they've all gotten sick in some way or other, some kind of disease, you know, or disorder. And imagine that was flipped. And that's just one of the reasons I'm on this path, because I saw them and I was like, I don't want to end up like them. I don't actually think that's the holier path. I think there's a way that I can really honor myself. I can honor my feminine and my needs. And imagine how much more I can give to the world when I'm filled up, you know? So I think that's what I would say to that. And in terms of worshiping yourself, this is where it gets so convoluted. My mom also thinks this. The evangelical world thinks, oh, this is all just like self-worship. It's an idolatry because they're making themselves God or the earth God or something. When you actually have a revelation of divinity, of like creator consciousness, of the divinity and the consciousness that is riddled in everything. When you see that and you feel yourself as truly part of that and as like a fractal of the divine, like you cannot help but fall on your face in adoration and like wonder at the mystery and the beauty and the miracle that is life and is consciousness. And yes, some people might get caught in the egoic like, oh, I am God, therefore whatever. But then they're not doing the shadow work, looking at the parts of you that you don't normally see and like actually going in and seeing, okay, this is the part of me that wants to be worshipped as God. This is the part of me that wants to be put on a pedestal. This is the part of me that wants to be seen by others, be adored by others. It's like, okay, I have these parts. I'm not going to let them run me. I'm going to listen to them. I'm going to make a space for them. I'm going to let them express. And then we're going to come into integrity and I'm going to come from a humble place. Do you know what I mean?
From what you've described so far, it honestly sounds like shadow work is the only thing that keeps you from going into like a drug sex fueled spiral. It feels like that's the thing that's grounding you.
I don't think it's the only thing, but it's a really important thing. It's also a way to keep you out of emotionally immature interaction. Okay, so for example, let's say you're in a relationship and you get triggered. This happens to everybody. And then all of a sudden, you're like saying really horrible, mean things to your partner. Or you're speaking from a place that's like doesn't even sound like you. It sounds like your 8-year-old self is talking, really.
That's how I feel whenever I talk to tech CEOs on Twitter. I don't know what gets over me, but I'm like so mean to them.
And so, you know, I would say that when it comes to this shadow aspect, there's unconscious parts of ourselves that take the steering wheel.
Yes.
Right? There are these parts that get triggered or angry and are just like, And then it's almost like, I don't know what came over me.
Mm-hmm.
I just got so triggered or emotional about something and I did something that's actually not me. Mm-hmm. That wasn't me coming from a place of love
mm-hmm.
or curiosity or openness. That was me like trying to shut it down, trying to burn everything to the ground. And so when she says shadow work, that means that you putting in the actual personal development work to look at the aspects of you that are in the shadow, AKA unseen. Right.
We usually only see them when we're triggered.
And we only see them when they're triggered. Or we don't even see them. And they just take the driver's seat and we're like, oh, yeah, okay. That's what happens. Yeah, no. And so I would say, also answering your question, is that, you know, in this spiritual conscious community, it's like any community. You're going to have people that are really in integrity and doing it to the best of their abilities. And you're also going to have people who are kind of using it as a facade, as a mask, to pump their egos. And unfortunately, in, we'll say, the erotic community or the aero-spiritual community, there's a lot of amazing people. And there's also a lot of people who are playing escapism,
mm-hmm.
right? Who are like, you know, I'm just gonna use these spiritual terms here and play out my kinks. And that gives it a horrible name. And I would say in every community, in any religion, there's people that are actually practicing it with their whole heart, that are amazing, that are doing the best that they can. And then there's other people that are using it for their egos. It's coming from that shadow place, that blind spot that they don't see. There's something else that's taking over that wants to be seen, that wants to be powerful, that's filling a void, something like that. And so to also bring it back to being self-sourced, being able to come from a place of wholeness for yourself. So anything that you're giving outside of yourself is from a place of overflow. And so to answer your question, is it selfish to be in this practice to fill yourself up first? No, I think it's really important to fill yourself up first. What happens when a plane is going down? They say, make sure you put your mask on you first before helping your child.
I mean, people say that, but I just feel like if I were in that situation, if a kid were next to me, I would not be able to put my mask on first.
You're truly selfless.
No, I would feel bad if like the child died.
And I think really the principle that's coming from that is you can't help anyone else until you yourself are in a place to actually help or serve, right? And so if I am helping everybody else first, right, there's only so much I can do before I'm going to get depleted or run out of oxygen mm-hmm. in this analogy with the airplane, right? But to do something to where I actually am good, I can now serve at my fullest capacity and beyond is really how I'm going to make an impact, a way bigger, more massive impact,
mm-hmm.
right? And so that's really my response to then people saying, oh, well, you're just being selfish. You're just being self-indulgent. You're just filling yourself up first. No, actually, my intention is to serve at a greater capacity. My intention is to be able to fill myself up so that I am at my fullest, highest version to then serve.
From the overflow.
And I would say that there's people who's also giving this whole thing a bad name because they're actually just serving themselves.
They're takers.
And they're just takers. And unfortunately, I would say that that's true in every single community. And so you can't really look at one community because of the worst person and say, everybody's like that. You can't say, oh, the erotic mysticism is bad because I've seen some spiritual narcissists here. You can't say Christianity is bad because I've seen a lot of shamers in here. I grew up also with Christianity, and it was amazing. It was beautiful. There was so much truth in that. There was so much community and connection and amazingness to all of that. And I could see that and feel that. And there's also other people in Christianity that are very fear-based, that are very controlling in all of these ways. I don't agree with that. I do agree with this. And that doesn't make the whole thing bad. I see it for what it is. We're all humans, again, existing in totality, doing the best that we possibly can.
When you talk about, you know, doing the best we can and the shadow side, when you look at most religions, there is a framework for virtues and vices. Christianity has the seven deadly sins and the seven heavenly virtues. I cannot speak intelligently to other religions because I was, you know, raised Jewish. Judeo-Christianity and Islam share the same God and the same general tenets, but Christianity, you have sloth, wrath, pride, greed, gluttony, lust. Don't say it. I can remember it. Oh my God. Okay. We are drinking wine. We're not Austin sober here. Oh my God. There are all those animes with it too. Do you remember it? No, don't Google it. We have to let our brains remember it. No, actually, no, I'm not kidding. So it's like there's actually a whole thing with AI and ChatGPT. If you Google something instead of letting your brain remember it, it literally kills brain cells.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's like, it's just.
That's good to know.
Yeah. So like, it's really tempting to want to do it.
Okay. Is it, did you say gluttony?
Gluttony, yeah.
Okay.
Okay. One second. Oh, envy.
Envy.
Yeah, envy. Okay. See, we remembered it. Like, you Google something, if you don't remember it, you're essentially telling your brain you don't need to expend energy remembering things. So your short-term memory gets worse.
Yeah, I get that. I had a feeling about that because it's also, you're also still outsourcing. You're like, oh, I have a memory system outside of myself.
Is there a system like that in erotic mysticism? Would you rely on the Judeo-Christian one when you're talking about vices? Like, what is it?
What's the question specifically? Is there a way to create temperance or boundaries within?
It's like the shadow side. When you look at the shadow side, are there maybe just a few specific qualities that you see in people's shadow side? Can you categorize them all under the seven deadly sins, or does it exist outside of that?
I would say those are pretty accurate to what the shadow sides are, for sure. Those are coming from wounded places. So if you're operating out of any of those seven deadly sins or those shadows, it's because you have had an unmet need in at some point in your life, usually in childhood, that created some kinds of a way for you to try to get that need met that might have those flavors. Do you know what I mean? And maybe create addictive patterns. And so what's interesting, though, is if you bring love to any one of those things, if you actually bring unconditional love to any of them, they can transform. They begin transforming into virtues or into like an integrated version of those things. Lust with love transforms into eros, which is creative life force energy. Gluttony with love, if it's maybe not gluttony, but it's like the enjoyment of the senses and the enjoyment of food in a beautiful way, but like with temperance maybe and with love, turns into becoming a sensualist, being able to be like enjoying and so grateful for the food that you're given, and you can take it in and have like blissful experiences, ecstatic experiences with your food. And then when you do that and you get so deep and present, it's like you don't need to overeat. It's like every moment becomes that deeply satisfying thing. Do you know what I mean? So maybe it's whatever that deadly sin is mixed with love, mixed with gratitude, and mixed with temperance.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't have time to go into all seven, but maybe you can tell me your personal deadly sin. I've heard it said we all have one we are the most susceptible to.
Like a fatal flaw?
Yeah, like mine is pride. Every single bad thing in my life, anytime I've been really upset or done something I've regretted, it's been because my pride has been injured. I would say I'm a pretty controlled person. The other sins in adult life I've never really experienced, but pride... Pride is my bad one. So I'd love for you to tell me what I could do about it. And then also for you to tell me yours and what you've done about it. It's true. I don't have greed, lust, sloth, envy. None of those have been a problem in my life. But pride is so bad. And it's the worst one. Objectively, it's like, this is why we're not in the Garden of Eden. I don't even believe that. But like, you know, pride is like in every religion, every group, pride is always seen as the worst one.
All of the seven deadly sins I've experienced in some way and grown from. But what's coming through for me right now in this moment is I have a huge need to feel significant in my romantic partnership, in my professional career, and also in my social circles. There's a desire for me to feel significant. And there's nothing actually wrong. I don't believe there's anything wrong about wanting to feel significant, but there is an aspect of myself, my ego, that wants it really, really bad.
But is that from greed or pride? Is it from a, like, I want to possess this and have it only for me? Is there a,
no, it's pride. I would say it's pride. I would say it's ego at this point. And, you know, there's nothing that I actually do to manipulate or make that happen at this point. But it still is something that I notice where I'm like, oh, whoa, okay. there's actually an aspect of me that's wanting to be significant right now. And because of that lack that I'm feeling in this moment about not feeling significant, I'm kind of acting like a little bit of a baby. I'm kind of doing things that are outside of myself or a little bit outside of my integrity. Or maybe I'm not even acting on it, but internally there's a chaos storm happening inside. And that's something, just that awareness for me allows for me to be like, oh, wow, okay, I'm outside of my center. I'm outside of being the best version that I possibly can be. And I can actually communicate that to whoever I'm with to actually address the elephant in the room. Everett, why are you being so weird right now? Oh, I'm actually, whoa, okay. Oh, there's a need for me to feel significant in this moment right now. That's totally my ego. I take responsibility for that. I'm sorry for being this way. I recognize that there's a part of my ego that wants to feel significant and loved. Let's get clarity. Let's speak to some clarity on that. And so, yeah, that's kind of one that I've had challenge for.
You've been telling me and how you also solved it. You were just like, oh yeah, it's been hard. What do you do?
I believe that there's so much duality in this world, and to reconcile paradox is really where the sweet spot is when we're kind of reconciling the two different things. And so my need to be significant has, on one hand, driven me to excellence, to achieve excellence, to be the best version of myself that I possibly can be. Love that. Grateful for it. My also desire and need to be significant has stunted my growth because I'm puffing my chest out. I'm posturing. I'm trying to be bigger than I actually am. I'm not asking for help. And so those two fighting and clashing together within my body or within my mind or within my heart has actually created a lot of conflict in my life. And so just by simply acknowledging to myself, first and foremost, it's like, dude, you really want to feel significant. Come on, let's be real.
Owning it
is a big thing. Doesn't matter what deadly sin or whatever it is that you're dealing with, just to simply be like, I'm going to own the fact that I really want to be significant. For most people who don't want to face it, it just stays buried. And it's something that's there, but is not looked at. And really, a way that I actually like to explain or personify these shadow aspects of ourself is, imagine there is, some sort of creature or beast, or we'll say dragon, for example, right? Imagine there's a dragon that you're locking in the dungeon. That dragon represents this desire to be big, to feel significant, whatever it is. Really, what happens when you lock that thing away is it's misunderstood and it's pent up. And any moment that it has a chance to get out, it's going to get out and wreak havoc, right? It's going to blow fire over everything. It's going to burn everything down. But really, when we're doing what we're calling shadow work, is we're actually facing that dragon that's locked up and meeting it where it's at and understanding, hey, actually, you're not angry and you are angry, you are dangerous, but let me look past that. Mm-hmm. Whoa, you're actually wounded. Mm-hmm. You're actually hurt. Mm-hmm. You're actually in pain. Mm-hmm. Why are you in pain? Let me understand you. And to meet aspects of ourselves that are actually hurt, disguising themselves as angry, vicious beasts, it's actually, that's not working, right? And so to actually meet them in the pain point is how we can actually start to build relationships with them. And then eventually they're no longer breaking out and wreaking havoc because they become your greatest allies. Imagine having a dragon, being a dragon rider of that aspect of ourselves. And so for me, that version of dragon in this example of significance is that version of my dragon is my drive to excel and be excellent and be the best version that I can. I don't ever want to suppress that version of myself, but hey, I understand you, man. You really want to be seen because you've been hurt a lot in the past. I understand that. And it's okay. You don't have to do that. Let's harness the talent. Let's harness really what wants to come through here from that.
I feel like mine is probably pretty similar, but my own flavor. But I want to go somewhere different because we just went deep into this. Yeah, I also have need to be seen and heard and all the things. But in my life, I have had bouts with some other ones for sure. So I had an eating disorder as a teenager. I was anorexic. It created some huge problems in my body and hormones. And then when I hit my 20s, I had no hunger or full mechanisms because I'd starved myself for so long. So I became fully gluttonous. And just would eat and eat and eat and then try to throw up and I couldn't throw up and just eat and eat because I just couldn't, never felt full enough, you know? And then I had to get to a point where I was just like, I couldn't even move after eating. Like I'd be on the ground in so much pain and like I had to get to a point where I started balancing it, you know, and I was like, this is so not worth it. It was like a chemical, biochemical situation that I was in around gluttony, but I did actually find a way to temper that. And that was by learning that I could eat fat again, like healthy, organic butter, animal fat I wasn't eating. And when I started eating that stuff, it really balanced my systems. And then I was like, oh, I would actually feel full for once rather than binging on carbs and sugars and things like that, you know? So I had to go down this really deep path with gluttony, if you want to call it that, in order to come back to like an equilibrium in myself. And ever since then, I think I was about 25 when I really healed that. I'm 40 now. I don't overeat. Like, it's so rare that I overeat. It's so rare that I get a stomach ache after eating because I just know exactly what to give my body at all times. So that's one example. And then I also have gone through for sure with lust. Like, I was married at 21 in the Christian church and was feeling all of these attractions and sexual feelings towards other people while I was married because I was so unfulfilled sexually in my relationship and had no pleasure in sex in my early marriage. I was totally shut down in that area. When I left that marriage and then, yeah, I was just like exploring sexuality in a different way for the first time in another relationship. And then we opened our relationship because I'd only have ever had those two sexual partners. And it was like I was trying to figure out the difference between love and lust and my desires and what I needed and choosing certain things in my life for my partner and his needs to be met versus what I was really wanting and needing. There was a whole dynamic that I had to navigate around that. And then being out of integrity with my partner because I was not in integrity with myself and lying about something and then having to come out with it. Like, just a whole journey around lust and sexuality that I had to go on to really discover what is true for me and what's an integrity for me. And then being single for years and exploring sex with different lovers and partners or sexuality or lovership or whatever, you know, and then coming to a place where, you know, we're monogamous or monogamous right now. You know, we don't, if you think that erotic mysticism or neo-tantra is all about having sex with whoever you want all the time, like, it's so not true. Most people on this path that I know are either celibate or have been celibate at some point, and they're practicing like very conscious relationship, whether with one person or maybe more than one, but it's like very conscious, very intentional, very sacred to them. I love being in this monogamous container at this point in my life because of how much we're able to create together and alchemize together in that container. So it's not like it's some free-for-all hippie movement or something like that.
I feel like many religions and spirituality movements arrive at the same conclusion. It's nice to be just with one person. Why is that? I mean, every single religion I can think of, every single spiritual movement ultimately culminates in just be with one person.
I mean, I think that it becomes less complicated. I would say the difference between monogamy and polyamory, not that one is better than the other. When you're balancing multiple relationships, there's multiple relationships that you're managing and needing to connect with and needing to fulfill and all of that. And so the layers of complexity just exponentially increase. Not to say that that's good or bad or better or worse, but it's really up to you what you want your walk of life to be. I would say that for me, what's really possible when two people are fully devoted to each other in romantic partnership and life partnership is you get to now explore the infinite playground of what's possible between what you two do. And so something that we also like to teach and share with other people is there is a whole erotic playground to explore just with one person, right? And so a lot of times we're like, what do you mean? Like, we have sex and that's it. That's good enough, right? No, absolutely. I mean, if it's great for both of you, fine, awesome. And if you're both wanting to explore more with each other, there's a whole playground or theme park, we'll say, with all these other different kinds of rides that you can do with your partner in ways that are sacred and loving, right? And so think just creatively all of the different experiences and growth aspects that you can do erotically, intimately, and sexually with your partner, with your person. And so it really just depends on where you are at in your walk of life.
And also seeing your relationship as a spiritual training ground or as, you know, a path to enlightenment or a path to awakening. I think that's a really important and foundational piece of what we practice and what we both believe is that you don't have to be a celibate monk on a mountain meditating to find God or spiritual enlightenment, actually the path of partnership is going to take you there and do a lot of karmic healing in a very deep, quick, profound way, you know, if you do it intentionally.
Very interesting. So when you talk about that and mastering your sexuality, how can the average person undertake the hero's journey for their sexuality? Like, what's the way to do that?
I love thinking about the hero's journey in sexuality, almost from codependency or from outsourcing to sovereignty, that kind of arc or that journey, you know, coming from uncontrolled and unconscious patterns that you've probably inherited, your parents and your ancestors, and just kind of mindlessly going through those patterns and motions in yourself to becoming conscious of them. First, the first step on it is like actually realizing I'm in a pattern, I'm in a loop, and I can't get out of it, and naming it and owning it and taking responsibility for it and looking at yourself. And that's probably the hardest fucking step, is like admitting to yourself that this is a pattern I'm in and it sucks and I'm hurting myself and I might be hurting others and I have hurt others. I have hurt myself and I betrayed myself and all these things, and just like seeing it for the truth of what it is. And then moving from owning it and taking responsibility to actually even like loving on it, to being exactly what Everett was saying about the dragon, is being like, oh, I see the parts of you that are so hurting, that are so sore, that are just like this inner like 3-year-old curled up in a corner crying, like feeling so abandoned and so hurt and so unloved. And like doing practices to bring so much love and compassion to the pain body parts of you, you know? And then from there, really transforming that stuck energy, that shame energy, transforming that into pure potential energy that empowers you to turn your pain into your purpose, you know? To turn your mess into your message, as Ev likes to say. It's like actually taking that stuff and turning it into something expansive rather than being shut down and constricted and like in this, like the shame position is really like, you know, hiding. It does that in your body. Totally. So you can transform that position that your body takes into a power position and like let that turn into fuel for your fire, for your purpose. And then it's like, oh my God, I'm now self-sourcing. There's practices for like every time you see that you're reaching or trying to take or like going outside yourself to try to fill yourself, to look at that, to give yourself the love you need. One of the practices I do is literally holding a pillow, pretending it's my inner child and like talking to her the way I wish my mother or my father would have talked to her. Just holding her and comforting her, you know, or looking in the mirror and telling myself the things that I need to hear. Like those are such important practices, and they start reprogramming your brain, your neural pathways, creating new neural pathways, new patterns in your nervous system so that you're no longer having to go to those places. You're no longer recreating those same unhealthy patterns. You're starting a new pattern of sovereignty.
I feel like everyone in the city of Los Angeles could use that.
Because it's suppressed. That's the thing. When erotic energy is suppressed like that, that's when it goes out sideways. This is why I think it's really important in any spiritual community that people are doing the shadow work. It just comes back to that over and over and over again. And where there's a safe space for you to be able to like share what's going on in you and share the deep, dark stuff and then transform that and transmute it.